all over your organization, every part of your organization needs cybersecurity. And that means the security manager, the chief security officer, has to be everywhere because that threat landscape and risk is everywhere across the organization. You add all that up with the systems that must not fail, and it's just not conducive to having time to step back and look at yourself. You're just running as fast as you can to try and keep up, and probably failing to keep up at that point anyway. So I think it's very important that you start to protect time, protect routines that you know are serving you. I would choose people from around the business who I thought had influence, who would then tell their story about security. And so I started to create this whole communication strategy, which came from lots of other people apart from me. And that worked incredibly well because that created that social pressure.
This is the Human Firewall Podcast with Dr. Niklas Hellemann.
And welcome to today's episode of our Human Firewall Podcast. And today I have a very special guest, Andrew Rose, who is the Chief Security Officer at SOSIF. But not only that, Andrew has a wealth of experience in the industry, so in the security industry, with a strong focus on people-centric topics. And across his career, he has transformed security management for multiple major organizations like Vocalink, which is a MasterCard company, the UK National Air Traffic Control Provider, NATS, so it's the main air traffic control provider, and two of the Magic Circle law firms, which are Clifford Chance and Allen Overy. But he also worked as a principal analyst at Forrester Research, like covering the awareness and culture change space, so what now is called human risk management, very recently. But he also has been recognized for his outstanding contributions in the field, various awards several times, European CISO of the year 2018 by SC Awards. He has been also part of the CSO 30 list every year since its inception in 2020. And he also has been awarded the UK Awareness Campaign of the Year at the UK Cybersecurity Awards. As I said, in February this year, he joined SOSIFE as our Chief Security Officer. And apparently, I welcome you to our Human Firewall Podcast. Hi, Andrew. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Niklas. Great to be here.
How are you? How are things in the UK?
They're fine. It seems to be sunny for the first time in a long time today, so I'm not quite sure how that happened. But yeah, things are good in the UK. All going all right. Thank you.
Cool. We want to do one new thing in our podcast and, you know, breaking the ice. We actually don't have to break the ice because we have been working together quite extensively already for the last couple of months, but maybe we still learn something about each other. So it will be five questions, and I would like to ask you to choose between one of the two alternatives. I will present you with two alternatives. So let's kick it off. Would you say you are more an early bird or a night owl?
I think probably right now I'm an early bird. I think I've gone through different phases in my life where I've been sort of a night owl. And certainly when I was working in London, I used to have to get up really early to get to work. So I was definitely an early bird then. I think I'm probably a little bit more of a controlled early bird. So I get up and do a run first thing in the morning before I log on to work. So yeah, early bird for me.
Oh, I like that. A controlled early bird. It's super similar with me. Probably 10 years ago, I was a night owl. You know, when I did my PhD, like I worked like until the wee hours. But I also went for a run today, very early, and probably my past self is laughing at me right now. So you mentioned work. So this is a tough one. Would you rather face a ransomware attack or a DDoS attack?
I don't think that's a tough question at all. I think that's quite an easy one. I would much rather go with a denial of service attack because once it stops, it's done. You're back to normal. Once ransomware is delivered and is done, you're left with a devastated organization, which needs an awful lot of rebuilding. So yeah, DDoS is a much easier one.
I mean, also DDoS at a certain point stops it by itself, right? Well, in some cases.
And it's a bit easier to get controls for DDoS as well. You know, so it's definitely my choice would be DDoS.
So maybe the next one is a little bit harder. Earl Grey or German Bratwurst? I don't know if you had German Bratwurst.
That's an easy one as well.
Yet.
I think I probably have, but I would definitely go with a good Earl Grey tea. Definitely. No milk, no lemon, just as it comes. But Earl Grey over the German Bratwurst, I'm afraid.
To be very honest, same for me, actually. we talked about it. I'm a huge tea fan, so, and I don't like sausages too much. Would you rather live without your password manager or without MFA, multi-factor authentication, for all accounts?
Oh, that's a strong one because they've both got benefits. I like the fact that the password manager sort of verifies that you're on the right page so you don't enter it onto a spoof page. However, but it's also a single point of failure. So if that password manager is compromised, I've lost all my passwords in one go. So I think I'd rather live without that than live without MFA because I think MFA is a good strong control. It's not infallible, but yeah, I think that adds, you know, that second layer of defense. So I'd go with MFA.
Yeah,
that's the one I would want to keep. rather than get rid of.
And then again, a non-work question. During your lunch breaks, do you eat lunch outside or you bring your own home-cooked food or do you cook your own food for lunch?
I think it depends where I am, I guess. If I'm at home, I work from home sort of quite a bit. So I'll go downstairs and make my own lunch. But if I'm out traveling or going into the office, I'll buy something. I can't be bothered making lunch early in the morning and thinking ahead like that.
Yeah, not a meal prepper.
No, I'm afraid not though. Yeah.
Okay, let's dive into our real topics or the topics you want to talk about. So apparently, I mean, you have worked as a chief security officer, chief information security officer for many years. You have looked at the industry as an analyst at Forrester. So apparently today I want to talk with you about the challenges, the typical challenges and how they changed of a CISO over the years. Also, you know, the current challenges we see when we look at the industry. And then apparently we also want to look at how the industry itself changes.
Okay.
First of all, maybe, I mean, we have an informed audience here. I mean, many security professionals, but we also have some people that are just interested in cybersecurity. So maybe let's take us away a little bit more. What is a chief information security officer? What's a CISO? And what's the main challenges for a CISO or the main responsibilities?
Oh, good Lord. So it's a really difficult question to answer because it depends so much on so many variables. The CISO generally is the most accountable person in your organization for security of information and systems and services. And sometimes that's a very senior role, very strategic, you know, reporting directly into the board. And in some organizations, it's not. It reports into the CIO and it's a technical role. And I think that's one of the great challenges we face is not all CISOs are the same because not every organization is the same because they all face different risks. So you'll find one CISO who's just responsible for security operations and identity management and perhaps network security. But then you'll get to the next level of maturity and they're responsible for risk management and governance and policy and supplier risk and awareness and training. And then you get to the next level of maturity where they're responsible for DevSecOps and privacy and product security and business continuity and physical security. So it's one of the challenges about the role is the fact it's so broad because security is embedded into everything that pretty much every organization does. You want to create a new service, you need to make sure that's resilient and won't be taken down by attackers and you won't be held to blackmail over it. If you are creating new intellectual property, then you need to make sure that is secure and belongs just to your organization, doesn't leak out. If you have a new product you're designing, you need to make sure that can't be attacked by hackers and information stolen from it. So it's all over your organization. Every part of your organization needs cybersecurity. And that means the security manager, the chief security officer, has to be everywhere. Everywhere. He has to be working with the lawyers. He has to be working with the compliance guys. Has to be working with the product guys. Has to be working with the finance team. Has to be working with the deep technical guys. You have to be everywhere because that threat landscape and risk is everywhere across the organization. So one of the challenges is the CISO has to be an expert in almost everything and have their head on a swivel, continually looking in different directions, looking for the new threats, the new initiatives the organization is going, and then try to understand how that could turn into a threat to your business value. And you have to do that all while never failing. Because if you fail, then your organization suffers in terms of reputation or costs, etc. So it can be a pressure role. But it's the scale of it is one of the biggest challenges I think that CISOs face.
And let's keep that you must never fail thought in the backs of our heads, because I definitely want to talk about that as well, and also the connected pressure. But you said one thing, and that's also my mental model, like the pivotal point or the pivotal element is risk, right? It's a discussion about the risk. And the risk is very specific for various different companies or different organizations. And if it's a very technological thing, or we had, for example, the CIO of Vodafone Germany, Uli Irne here, he said, okay, apparently their first view goes to networks, right? Because keeping up the network stability for a telco is one of the most important things. How did the role of the CISO or the challenges, how did that change over the course of like the last 10 to 20 years? I mean, I assume that 20 years ago, it was mainly focused on IT.
Yes, it was. There's a definite sort of maturity journey I talk through, actually. And I talk, it started with just compliance. I need to be compliant with the regulations that are out there. And then it developed into IT security. It's like, can you stop our systems getting viruses, please? That's all I want you to do. And then it developed into, well, hang on a second, our information has value, doesn't it? So let's protect the information. So then it moves to the next level, which is information security. And then you start protecting the information and you realize that intellectual property is important and the information enables you to provide services. Then it took a step and moved to cybersecurity. And I think that's where, you know, you start to protect services rather than just information. You know, can we still provide our service to our customers? And if we do have a breach and we fail, can we recover and get back from that? And so cybersecurity is where we're at right now. But actually, I think we're about to move into the next phase of this, which is cyber resilience. And that's all about effectively never having that downtime. Can you maintain your services up and running, even though you know you've been compromised? And I guess a poster child for how not to do this is probably the Colonial Pipeline incident that happened, where actually they got some sort of malware in their billing system. And because of that, they switched off their pumping capability.
Which had tremendous effect even internationally. I mean, nationally in the United States. So there was a shortage of gas supply. But I mean, everybody could read it in the news, right?
It was huge, huge impact because a billing system was infected. And you have to sort of think, how can I in my organization segregate my network, segregate my core systems so that if I do see that one system has been compromised, if I've got a hacker on my network, I can still produce the core value to my customers and still keep the services running. And that's something you need to think about. But it does become difficult because one of the big changes in the past 10 to 20 years is complexity. You know, there are so many systems now interwoven to provide that value chain to enable you to provide value to your customers that it becomes very difficult to sort of to unpick that and really understand all the controls that you need to have in place. It's not just a case of, well, I have to protect this one system. It's now I have to protect this one system, which is connected to 15 other systems and takes data feeds from the internet and relies on a mainframe in our basement. And, you know, takes data from a satellite, which takes data from somewhere else. It becomes a really complex web of information services all working together to produce one outcome. And so protecting that becomes so much more difficult because you can't just draw a line around it and go, right, I'll just put a firewall and put some access control and we're done. Now it's a sprawling, you know, plethora of systems woven together, and it becomes much more difficult to even understand, never mind protect.
Mm. Especially if you also maybe don't have any control over certain parts of the systems because it's an external provider, right? And so talking about supply chain security, right?
Absolutely. Oh, my gosh. And supply chain security is a whole topic we could spend the whole hour talking about on its own. But that's very true. You know, you rely on third parties to provide services to you to enable your business to work. And how do you understand the threat that they may bring to you? It's very difficult to do because, you know, you're bringing in their software, you're bringing in their services, you're perhaps bringing in their manpower. But actually really digging into that organization to understand all the threats they have, it's just like doubling your workload. But it's not just doubling it because you've got 50 suppliers, 100 suppliers, 1,000 suppliers. So how do you get into enough sufficient detail to understand the threat that they may present to your organization? It becomes a difficult task to manage, shall we say.
And I mean, like double underlining, there's a lot of complexity, even if there weren't any attackers, right? So that it would already be very, yes, very complex. Yes. And I mean, to our audience, we're not going to double click on the whole supply chain risk topic, but maybe that's a super cool topic for an upcoming episode. But maybe let's switch to the threat landscape. So apparently, I mean, complexity is one thing, but then many things have changed in the threat landscape as well over the last 10 years, I would say. So what are trends that you see there?
Definitely the big trend, I guess, we've seen is the adoption of cloud services. That's probably the biggest sort of trend that we've seen, that and remote working, which is all intertwined. And so we've actually seen that your data no longer sits within your own walls. It's no longer in your data center. Your data is now spread on servers across the globe. And you probably think you know where they are, and it probably is there and some other places too. So it becomes a very different way of protecting of the information, because you can't just draw a line around it and protect that. It's now all over the place. It's in different places all around. And that's probably the biggest change we've seen in the past decade, I guess. But I think there's a lot of stuff coming up in terms of, you know, the new threats that are coming along. So we're seeing obviously AI. We won't double down on AI today either, because that's another at least an hour conversation. But AI is out. We're seeing citizen developers is a thing I've talked a lot about recently. And that's sort of like, it's taking the concept of shadow IT to the next level. So shadow IT is where you find that parts of your business have actually gone and bought technology solutions and not told you about it as a security manager. And therefore, you can't protect the data because you don't even know where it's gone or who's using it or how it's being stored. Citizen developers as a concept is something that was seeing in certain organizations where they're starting to employ smart people from universities who show up and say, well, I can script in Python, and we've got a database locally, which is full of good information, and we've got this AI service over here and this internet web database over here, and I can weave all those together to create a solution which really works in my department. And so they end up creating actual applications and solutions which become invaluable to that department, but the IT team have got no visibility of whatsoever. And one of the challenges is, in the olden days, as it were, like 2-3 years ago, when you went and bought a shadow IT solution, yes, it wasn't a great idea. It was a pretty bad idea. But at least those shadow IT people were pretty incentivized to try and produce at least some sort of security around their solution. But when you have a citizen developer using sort of low-code solutions and AI and external and internal data feeds, they have no concept of security. They have no accountability to weave security in. So they end up creating all sorts of untold issues and threats for the organization. So that's another thing that's coming along. So it's one of the things that's so much fun about the environment, really, as working as a CISO, is the fact that there are so many threats out there. And the old threats don't go away, but new threats come along. And I did a study, I did a study and asked CISOs what they most worried about, what threats they're most worried about. And you know what? The answers came back pretty flat. They were worried about everything pretty much to the same level. And it just gave me the impression that CISOs don't really know where the next punch is coming from. So they're worried about everything to an equal level, which is quite interesting.
Which is a super interesting cue because, I mean, one topic that we talk about all the time, and when we talk to CISOs, there's another thing, all consequence coming from that, what you just described, like the feeling that there is a constant threat stream, and the other thing you mentioned, you must not fail, right? If there's a breach, if there's an attack, you have failed. That is something that really leads to very, very direct consequences, emotional consequences in security personnel. And I mean, on top of that, we are currently looking at now almost 4 million in unfilled positions in the security industry. So there's not enough people. There's this constant stream of perceived stream of risks and attacks and a very high pressure not to fail. So talking about mental health in the security industry and amongst security professionals is something that we believe here at SOSIF, we have to do more. What's your perspective?
It's definitely a topic that needs to be brought up because it is a tough job. Being a CISO is a tough gig. You are constantly under pressure. You're getting phone calls at 3 a.m. about another breach that's just happened. You're then getting a phone call from your COO on a Sunday afternoon about prepping for the board meeting the next day. You don't get a great deal of downtime. And when you're in the office, you know, everybody wants a piece of you to get the business working and being effective as possible. So it is a full-on job. And that brings with it, you know, burnout issues. And I've certainly, you know, I've been through that loop myself where I had a CISO role which was burning me out. And, you know, I was, you know, on the hook for a 24/7 service, critical national infrastructure, and, you know, having to present to boards and regulators and oversight committees and, you know, with a must not fail attitude. It, you know, it had to be perfect every time. And when it isn't, that starts to, you know, you start to have the pressures of trying to recover, trying to get things working. And as we said earlier, it's such a complicated space that you can never be 100% in security. You have to be risk focused, but often boards and regulators don't perceive it that way. They demand 100% success. So I've certainly been really stressed and burnt out in situations like that. And it's tough. And I think people who are coming up the career ladder, I think perhaps see that CISOs are under this pressure and don't really fancy it. They can get good salaries doing, you know, head of SecOps or head of security architecture or the head of jobs, but they don't need to be the CISO. So I think we will find that as us older gentlemen retire and walk away from the CISO roles, you may find that other people are perhaps not as enthusiastic to pick up the mantle that we pass on.
Which would then even further increase the whole talent crisis or the whole talent shortage that we're looking at and increase that problem. But let's maybe double click a little bit more, if you like, to your personal experience, which I find obviously very, you know, interesting. And I think it's a good example also for these young people that are now in the security industry. I mean, what was the consequence? Like, you felt this pressure. And I mean, as a psychologist, I mean, that's what we learn in university. It's a slippery slope, right? You don't just wake up and you suddenly realize, oh, now I have burnout. It's a development of various symptoms over time, right?
I think it is. It's interesting. I've been chatting to people about this topic ever since I went through this phase. But I got to the situation where I was having chest pains in the office. And that was a huge wake-up sign to me that, you know, this can't continue. The pressure I've been under for X number of months, and it was just, it's intolerable and I need to do something about this. But I think many people do get to that stage. You just, it's the whole concept of boiling a frog, isn't it? You just, as long as you do it slowly, it doesn't notice. And I think the same thing happens in the CISO role. You're under stress and you're under pressure, and then you're under a bit more pressure, and you just accommodate it until something happens. And I've certainly spoken to people who've been through this in other industries. And there's one guy I was chatting to, and he said that suddenly his boss had a complete meltdown over a really insignificant fact. And it was like, that fact wasn't the deal. That wasn't the stressor. It was the fact that that was the one straw on the camel's back that just pushed him over the edge. And it was all of the other stuff that had pushed him to that spot. And so I think, you know, the chest pains that I got were very much that was the final straw. That was the signal to me to go, you've got to be aware of this. It's my body screaming out to me to say, you've been under stress for too long. You need to act on this. Otherwise, you're going to have real, you know, health consequences. So I think it is a big deal. And I think people do need to talk about it. And there are panels, and I've spoken to lots of CISOs about this, and we all find our own different way. You know, some of them have admitted to drinking too much to try and relax themselves. Some of them, you know, have got more positive ways of dealing with it. But we all need to figure out our own way through stress management and do it mindfully. That's the one thing. And all the research I've done about this topic since is the fact that I was dealing with my stress in my own way, but I wasn't doing it mindfully. I just knew that on a Saturday, my wife had to leave me alone and I'd have a day where I'd just do my own thing and decompress. But I didn't realize that that was effectively keeping me alive. And so if she said, let's go shopping or let's go out for the day, I would, but then I wouldn't have my de-stressing day. And it's only when you look back, you start to think, well, what was it that was keeping me, you know, keeping the lid on this? And then once you identify that, you can then start to say, right, well, I'm going to protect that. I know that this is doing me a service. Therefore, if I have a hobby I need to do, which helps me, or if I have a certain routine I do, I know I need to protect that because it's serving me. And don't just let the whole thing mindlessly happen. You have to be very specific because it's different for everybody. Everyone will find their own different de-stressors. So you have to find your own and then protect it.
And also look at the root causes, right? You talked about some of possible root causes. And if we look at psychological research, then a huge driver of depression and burnout is this what we call acquired helplessness. So being in a situation where there is a stressor, and there's some negative consequences, but you cannot control them. You cannot control the factors that are actually stressing you out. And I mean, you mentioned that example of, you know, that can be a boss that is erratic and you cannot really control his or her outbursts. But it also can be that feeling of a constant threat, right? Oh, we can be attacked anytime. And then I have to again go on these night shifts and have an incident and I'm going to be blamed for it. So like being very conscious about, or like gaining control again. And this is in many cases also just a mental thing, right? And obviously, we cannot control all the attackers. We cannot control all the most of the complexities we might be able to control, but maybe not with the budget that we have. But we need to come to a position and also shape maybe our security function around us in a way that we perceive control again. Mm-hmm. And this is something, I mean, you obviously left that specific role that gave you back the control, but maybe this is also a takeaway for our audience to really get back into control. I mean, look at active decompressing measures. But in the end, if you're exposed too long to a situation that you really cannot control, then the direction in for many, many people will be that direction of a mental health problem. And this is something we need to talk about. Another thing that I find very remarkable is, I mean, you talked about the chest pains. Many, many people, remember talking to patients back then in my university time, the physical symptoms, that's where most people stop and think, okay, I need to do something. But actually, it's easier to start earlier if you really focus on your self-awareness, right?
Yeah, I think it is. But in the CISO job, you don't get time for self-awareness. I did a time and motion study on myself at the time in that role. And I was in about 7 hours of meetings every day and receiving between 150 and 200 emails a day. And I was commuting 4 hours a day as well. So you add all that up, with the systems that must not fail. And it's just not conducive to having time to step back and look at yourself. You're just running as fast as you can to try and keep up, and probably failing to keep up at that point anyway. So it's difficult to be mindful. So I think it's very important that you start to protect time, protect routines that you know are serving you, and just look for those issues. And you're right about gaining control as well. You know, perhaps in my instance, I'm not quite sure how that would have worked, but certainly for others, knowing that you can't stop every attack might be a stressor. Correct. But if you knew that your detection routines are really top-notch and your recovery processes are really well documented and rehearsed, that gives you the confidence to say, yeah, okay, so we do get attacked. It does get through. It does happen. But we're good at the next bit. We're good at recovery. We're good at detection. We can do it. I think that reduces the pressure as well.
Yeah. So focus on your organizational security posture or resilience. And that will also, in an ideal world, also have an effect on your mental health resilience individually.
Yeah, I think so.
That's maybe a positive note, because we apparently also want to, not to make it like sound as the security profession is that bad, because we also have to talk about the question, like, what can we do against this talent shortage? Because we need these professionals. I mean, we said, okay, there are ways of also shaping the security function that it doesn't really burn you out. But what else can we do to really excite our young talents for security?
Yeah. I mean, I have painted a pretty bleak picture there. So please don't take it that that's every day. It is a career that I would not swap for the world. I can't think of a more fun job to do than being in cybersecurity, where everything is so interesting and so important to society as a whole. So I can't think of a more engaging career. But I do think we need to focus more on what we can do to bring more people into it. And I sort of worry a little bit that IT has been now perceived as a consumable. So people are happy to develop apps, but people aren't quite as interested in, okay, well, what sits underneath that? What's the hardware and the networking and the virtualization layers that enable us to create apps? They're just interested in the actual, in the top level piece. So I think that probably marginalizes people coming into IT. You know, think about the car. Now, I remember my father, at weekends, used to get the hood of the car up and used to sort of tinker with the engine a bit. And now there's no way to do that anymore. It's all sealed units. Do not touch here. Just touch the yellow bits. Fill it with water and oil, and that's all you're allowed to do. And IT is becoming a little that way. So we still need to encourage people to understand how those engines work and get into them and have curiosity about that. I think we need to encourage diversity, definitely. I think still it's an oversaturated market for white male people in cybersecurity. And I think bringing in women, bringing in other cultures, bringing in more diverse, neurodiverse people as well. I think there's a huge opportunity to increase diversity to help us address this staffing crisis. And I think also automation. You know, why do we spend so long doing run-of-the-mill repetitive tasks, when actually what we could do is we could automate those and therefore clear up our own headspace to go and do more interesting, more challenging, more valuable tasks ourselves with the staffing that we do have. So I think automation is a really key point. And that's difficult to do. It is difficult to do in organizations which are complicated and where they always struggle to have an up-to-date asset register because things change so frequently. But if you can start to get that done, get that automation in place, you can free up huge amounts of time and resource to actually alleviate the staffing crisis just by using the resource that you have.
And there again, we are, even though we wanted to prevent it, at the AI topic, right? So because AI apparently is one of those areas, or like one of those levers we can use to further push automation or to even materialize automation. Cases are, for example, I don't know, in security operations, or what tangible cases do you see? The biggest levers we can pull?
What, in terms of AI?
Or automation in general?
I think AI is great. I think automation, AI and automation is a really good way forward, but I think you do need to consider about the data that goes into it, because organizations do struggle to get consistent data. You know, they'll have a joiners and leavers process for people joining the organization and leaving. But at any one point, is that joiners and is that list on their assets in the Active Directory ever 100% correct? Possibly not. You know, do they have every server listed that is current? Possibly not. And there can be big gaps in that, but actually all of those automation processes and those AI processes depend on you having the right data getting put in, because if you don't, then things can go awry. So you have to be careful with it. But there are some really good use cases in terms of automation. So if you see that somebody has, engaged with a phishing email And that has taken them to a website that you know to be malicious. And now their account is starting to do something which looks like suspicious activity. Then you can sort of detect that automatically. And then you can say, well, okay, I'm going to revoke this account's access, or I'm going to ask them to re-authenticate using multi-factor authentication, or I'm going to disable them from being able to see the sensitive data that they normally have access to. So you could do all that automatically within a matter of seconds, rather than just raising a SOC ticket, which will get dealt with in the next 24 hours, where the data could be gone. It's all too late. So there's automation there, which is really useful. But I think AI, again, brings a lot of opportunity to the table. And possibly the most interesting story I've heard on AI so far was speaking to a large global bank. And we were talking about AI. And we were talking about networks as well, network security. And like most organizations, I asked them, you know, do you have a single network diagram describing your global network? And the answer is always, no, we don't. We have a folder with 150 network diagrams in, but not one network diagram. And so that becomes really complicated to try and understand how your organization fits together and the potential vulnerabilities. So what they did is they put AI in front of this folder so they can ask reasonable questions of all of that network data. And they can say, oh, can you tell me which IP addresses are routable from the internet? And the AI will go through all that data and pull out and give them a logical answer. And they can ask questions like, well, how could I get data from network zone A to network zone F? And it could say, well, you'd route it via this route, and this is the way you do it without authentication. And it would give you insightful answers to very, very complicated questions. And I thought that was a genius way of doing it. I thought it was really smart and a lovely step forward that shows the real value of AI to enable, you know, security administrators and network admins to really understand the risks they've got and the work they can do and make them so much more efficient. So there's lots of opportunity there for this automation and AI to help.
Yeah. And I mean, similar cases that come to mind, and we're also looking into, or we're already running, for example, I mean, navigating your security policy as an end user can be maybe equally complex than your network diagram. But this is also a case, right, where you can like essentially translate or transform your security policy, which has been written with a different, you know, use case and audience in mind, like into language and into the questions that your specific end users have, right?
Absolutely. I remember I worked for one organization and our security policy was ridiculously long. Mm-hmm. It was very specific and very, very long. And I knew that not one person in the whole organization had read it because it was like a book. It was bigger than a normal book. It was ridiculous. So having an AI that could actually take your questions and pull the answers from the different bits of policy and give you a reasonable sort of human sounding answer, hugely valuable. Because then people can actually ask questions rather than just going and finding a big document and trying to find, well, which bit applies to me? And you know they won't do that. They won't do that for more than 5 minutes when they'll just lose patience and they'll just won't bother and they'll just do what they think is right. But if you can actually give them an interface where they can ask a reasonable human-like question and get a reasonable human-like answer, which says, yeah, you should do this. If you don't want to do this, go and speak to that person. That's so much more accessible. And I think that would really help the security teams generally, because we do get a bit of a bad rep occasionally for getting in the way, slowing things down, being annoying. So being able to be perceived as a bit more human, a bit more supportive, I think would be another benefit.
And most likely we will be talking about that use case further down the road in this year. But maybe using that cue and move over to the topic of human layer security. I mean, the human layer in security. I mean, you described the world where, you know, a huge part of security awareness or human layer in security or human layer security was just distributing the policy. And apparently we know that, I mean, this can't be the target of human layer security. But probably 10 years ago, it was like that. And it changed. So nowadays, and you specifically, but everyone essentially also at SOSIF, we're talking about security culture more than to just, you know, check the box, essentially. But what has changed and why are security cultures or security culture is increasingly important?
It is. I do speak to lots of CISOs and security culture is something they want. The problem is not many of them really know what that means. They don't really know what a security culture is. They just know they want one. And so I often have conversations around, okay, what does a security culture mean then? And actually, I think I've heard the phrase once, it's what you do when no one's looking. You know, do you make good choices or do you cut corners? Is speed your priority or is quality your priority? You know, when no one's around to watch you, which one do you go for? And that sort of gives you an indicator of your culture. a little anecdote I used, which I'm sure I've repeated to you before. But if you're driving along a motorway or an autobahn and the sign says 50 kilometers an hour and everyone is driving 70, what do you drive? Pretty much you drive 70. Everyone would. If you're on a different road and there's no sign, doesn't tell you what speed you're meant to do, but everyone is driving at 50, what do you drive? You drive at 52. Because, you know, the culture around you is providing indicators and boundaries, and that's providing the sign itself about what you should, what correct behavior is. And so if we can create a security culture in an organization, you're effectively doing that. You're creating a way of working where people will make correct choices, even though you're not there in the room with them, even though they haven't got a sign in front of them telling them what to do. And that is incredibly powerful because it turns your whole organization into a very different entity. And definitely, I remember my proudest moment was in an organization where I went to a sales meeting, and it was a 90-minute sales meeting to buy this cloud service. And I knew that the only thing standing in the way of this cloud service was me and my security concerns. And everybody else wanted it, and it was just me that was getting in the way. And so I thought, okay, this is going to be fun. I'm just going to be a pain in everyone's butt for the next 90 minutes asking awkward questions. And actually, that wasn't what happened at all. What did happen is everybody else in the meeting started asking really smart security questions. And I was just absolutely aghast. I was so, so pleased because I didn't need to be in the room. They were asking the questions whether I was there or not. And they were asking smart questions. And it just made me realize the whole organization had changed because of the culture change program we'd done. Now we had, you know, 5,000 security champions. We had security champion in every meeting. And so whatever came up, people would ask security questions and be mindful about taking risks and ask those questions about any new initiative. And that was just wonderful. And that's the goal. That's what you want to achieve from security culture is to make everybody into a security aware champion who will ask the right questions at the right time, even though you're not there.
Mm-hmm. Very fascinating. There's many, many super interesting elements here in that story, in that anecdote. I mean, one that I take away is, I mean, that shift towards, you know, like from leading indicators, very, you know, like the completion rate of an e-learning, right? That's something many people are still concerned with. But it's actually the lagging indicator or the target function, the behavior we want to foster, and not only the observable behavior in a certain situation, but a generalized behavior, right?
Yes, it is. I mean, I talk regularly about sort of my vision for that cultural journey. And I talk about, you know, awareness, behavior, and culture, ABC. Awareness is the first where you start, to build the information and the intelligence and the understanding about what are the problems and what do I need to do and what is the policy. And I think that's just the first step. But too many people, I think, perceive that as the only step. And so I speak to many security leaders who just think that I'll just create more and more security awareness and magically somehow culture will appear out of thin air. And that's just not how it works. You need to have much more of a structured model about that awareness. Then how do you turn awareness into behavior? And that behavior then needs the sort of the peer pressure to turn that into culture as well. So there's a whole sort of journey you need to go through to think it through. And this is where, you know, your area of behavioral science comes in really important, because it's not just about education. You know, we all know that education is fine and it has some impact. But when people are busy, when people are otherwise incentivized, like how many widgets have you made today or did you process all those invoices, they make different choices. And security is not that's not the be all and end all to them. It's not their imperative like it is for us. For them, it's just an annoyance which gets in the way of their day job. So they will be conflicted and perhaps make different choices. And so the behavioral science that you specialize in is the bit where the magic happens. That's where we turn that awareness and that understanding into actual physical activity, where they make different choices because of how we've educated them.
Yeah. Yeah, there's various elements or various drivers of behavior. Essentially, I mean, if you simplify it super strongly, it's the knowledge about the target behavior, right? So you always will need some form of education, but hopefully in 10 years, that's a very lean layer, because in an ideal world, you would only need to educate around the latest attacks or some technological advancements. But then you also need to motivate people. You need to really make them care and make them understand why it's so relevant for them. And then another thing, that's another super, super interesting and important element you mentioned, is that social aspect. Because as you described in that example, we are social beings. And apparently, we have a natural motivation to fit in and to replicate our role models or our fellow colleagues. So are there any things or like experiences from your past where you saw especially that social aspect being really, really well played or like addressed?
I can think of the opposite. Let me give the opposite.
Well, maybe let's start there. It's also a good place to learn from.
I remember a PA coming to me in one organization, and she came to me and said, I have a concern. I was like, okay, tell me what's going on. And she said, basically everybody in the PA department, when someone goes on holiday, we all just share our passwords. Because it's easier to do that than it is to share the calendars of all the calendars we look after, of all the execs we look after. And that obviously went against our policy. It went against all the processes, went against all the education that we'd been giving them. But it was really interesting to see that that's what she felt pressured to do, because the culture around her was that's how we do things here. We share passwords and we do that. You know, all of us do it all the time. And so the social aspect there was pressuring her to do something that she didn't feel comfortable doing, didn't want to do. Unfortunately, because she'd just started, she came and asked me about it, and we were able to start to change the culture in that department. But until that point, you know, that's what their culture had been. Their social pressure had been, we share passwords, we ignore the policy because it's easier that way. So it definitely is an impactor.
And this can be like super dangerous and increasing a risk tremendously, like because this is a tale of mixed signals. So most likely in this company, there was a training saying, okay, don't share passwords or don't write them on a post-it. But the actual observable behavior, especially for a new joiner, was the opposite. So essentially that leads to a situation where most likely any kind of training and certainly the policy is probably entirely ignored and disregarded. So we must focus more on the observable behavior and then try to influence it a little bit more, right? And you worked specifically with that department. What else could you do?
Absolutely. I mean, it very much is that social pressure wins every time. The policy was never going to win because they would just walk out of that meeting going, oh, I've been told not to share passwords, but that's what we do. That's how we work. So that they would always go and do that. They would always, the culture would always win. So it becomes then a challenge about, okay, well, how can I influence the culture to get the right messages through so people start to make the right choices? And we did quite a lot of work in one organization with some behavioral scientists and some data scientists as well, asking lots of questions regarding security and what they thought about security, what they believed. And it was interesting that it came down to one question, really, which was the biggest indicator of people's personal choices regarding security. And it came down to, does your direct line manager believe in security? And if they did, then the person believed in security and would do the right things. And if they didn't, then they wouldn't. And it was, of all the complex weave of questions we put together, this was the one question that came out as, this is the only important question to ask. And that changed the way that I did communication within my organization. I made sure from that point forward that it wasn't me that was sending out messages to all the individuals. I didn't do blanket communications to all the staff anymore, because what was that going to do? That wasn't going to change anyone's opinion. Hearing that, oh, surprise, surprise, the security manager thinks security is a good idea, that's not compelling. However, if I created the same messages and I broke them down into fundamental pieces and I started to give them to other people to communicate, that started to have an impact. So I would cherry pick, you know, line managers of different levels of seniority in different parts of the business. And I would get them to put intranet articles up about security. I would choose people from around the business who I thought had influence, like, you know, receptionists, who would then tell their story about security. And that would be published in, you know, in departmental magazines or whatever. And so I started to create this whole communication strategy, which came from lots of other people apart from me. And that worked incredibly well, because that created that social pressure. Everyone sort of looked at it and went, hang on a second, all these people are saying security is a good idea. Perhaps I'm the only one that doesn't think security is a good idea. Perhaps I should start paying more attention. And it was incredible. It worked incredibly well. And the other piece that I didn't expect was that the people who I actually gave the articles to publish, they needed to be congruent within themselves, because they just appeared in a magazine saying, I believe in security. And so actually we saw that their own security behavior improved because they just had their name associated with this article. So it was incredibly effective.
Yeah, cognitive dissonance reduction, right? They had to explain to themselves why they just appeared on the internet. I mean, this is awesome, especially because you're highlighting one very differentiated picture at, you know, involving the top management. Apparently, you mentioned some of these, I would call them nodes or security. I mean, in a sense, they were also security champions, but you picked them across various layers of the organization. So the usual talk track, if we talk about involving the top management, is, okay, manager escalation, right? So we need to involve the top management. But in this case, you did it much more in an organic way.
Yes. It's been a big belief of mine that I think that using the senior exec, which is the common model, everyone does this. They'll say, right, we'll get the CEO and whatever. They'll write an internet article and they'll say security is important to our business. And there you go, we're done. Everyone now knows it's important and they'll do the right thing. And it just doesn't work. I like to use the analogy or the similarity to trickle-down economics, which some of our listeners may have heard of. But the concept of trickle-down economics is you give tax cuts to the richest and biggest companies on the basis that money will trickle down into their salaries and they'll pay greater salaries to people, and therefore the people will have more disposable income. Theoretically, it seems like a pretty good theory. In reality, it doesn't work because the money doesn't trickle down very far. And I think the same is true of communication when we talk about this sort of thing. The exec will say, yes, security is important. And that'll trickle down a layer or two. But then it gets to a manager who's actually being measured on, again, how many invoices they've processed and how much sales they've made. And that's what their manager wants to know about. They don't ask about security. And so actually, it's already been lost by that point. You know, one or two layers down, already that message from the CEO is gone. So I don't believe that this top management piece is terribly important. I very much am a proponent of this middle out messaging, picking people across the organization to tell those security stories. And that just creates that peer pressure. It creates that social proof that security is important. And that changes the culture. Just having the CEO say security is important to us doesn't make much of a difference.
Mm-hmm. I'm still going to highlight that I find it very important in our organization, but apparently I totally agree. It's actually looking at similar mechanics we also see in social media, right? What you describe could be also, an influencer model.
Yeah.
Where we see that if you have an, you know, advertising spot on TV with a well-known celebrity, I mean, that works. But what we do nowadays is go much more deeper into smaller social circles and use influencers in these circles that have a much more direct effect.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about it like that, but that's a perfect analogy. It really is. You know, the society is getting broken into smaller and smaller echo chambers of opinion. And so actually having one big voice that goes over all of them doesn't really work anymore. So if we can find people who sit in each of those echo chambers to reflect the message, that's much more impactful because the people, they recognize the similarities. They see shared values. They see shared goals with those people. And therefore, it's taken a lot more seriously because that person's just like me. They're in the same boat as me. They're in the same social group as me. Therefore, I take what they say to be much more important. So yeah, it's a very good point.
And another thing I also find super interesting, because if we talk with our customers about security champion programs, right, it's something that especially larger companies run. In many cases, I see a dynamic or a mechanic that they rely on volunteers. And that's super cool because then you have highly engaged individuals, but they might not be evenly spread throughout all functions and departments. So I would understand your model here also a little bit, or your approach a little bit, to be more proactive and look at your organization as, you know, one playing field, and then be more conscious and more proactive about picking these influences.
Absolutely. You look at, you know, which are the business areas which have got the most risk in them. And then you can start to cherry pick, you know, different departmental heads to start to put messages. And again, it's relatively complicated to pick it all apart and do it. But you start to think about those aspects of what risks are we facing? What departments are carrying most of those risks, and what types of risks are they facing? Therefore, what story should they be pushing? You know, so having the finance team talk about CEO fraud or business email compromise is, you know, pretty good because that works for them. That's a threat that they face. Having, you know, perhaps the warehouse guys talk about physical security because it's more aligned with what they do. So you choose the messages and put them in the areas where it's going to resonate the most. And it's just another factor to think about when you're putting that communications plan together. But that does work. And building a champions network is a really good idea generally. It does require an element of work, definitely. It's not the easiest thing to do because you need to effectively have a two-speed security awareness campaign, because you need to keep all of your your normal user's educated to, you know, say level 80, shall we say. You know, so they've all got a good understanding of what they need to do. They're all compliant. But you need to make sure that your security champions are a step ahead of them. So they feel that they've got answers to questions that the normal user may come up with. You know, otherwise, there's no point having them as a champion if they're just educated to the same level. So it's a case of how do you feed and water your champions network to make sure these people feel that they're always a step ahead, that they're always connected and understand all the threats. But it's a really good thing to do. And it comes back to the issue we were talking about earlier about the staffing crisis in security. I think many CISOs have found that their champions network is a really good place to recruit from. So you can actually bring people from within the organization who bring different skills and insights and experience, but they bring that passion for security. And that's what makes a big difference. And your champions network becomes a great recruiting ground. It's just about sort of maintaining that and then rebuilding it and keeping it going, which can take a bit of work.
Mm-hmm. And a continuous piece of work, right? So, which is true for most activities nowadays in security, right? It's not a project anymore that is finished at some point. And obviously the same applies for security culture building. I want to double click on one connection to, you know, general organizational culture, because that's something we see that if you, for example, have a high power distance in an organizational culture, so nobody really likes to or like is afraid of, for example, approaching senior management or the CEO, and then there's suddenly a fake president fraud or a CEO fraud, then we see that this is a major risk factor. So the broader organizational culture being a risk factor for attacks. What do you think about this interconnection and, you know, in both directions of security culture, but also the broader organizational culture?
It's interesting. I immediately think about, I can't remember which airline it was, but there was an airline in Asia which changed their culture because they had a very hierarchical culture within this airline. And then they ended up having a plane crash because the captain said, we should do this maneuver. And the co-pilot did not feel empowered to challenge because of the hierarchy. And so he just went ahead with it and they did this maneuver and the plane crashed. And so in hindsight, what the airline did is they said, right, we're going to change the culture. From now on, we're not going to call each other captain. We're going to call each other by our first names because that makes people more accessible and more, we'll level the playing field a little bit. And now we're going to start to encourage people to challenge other people's beliefs and other people's decisions. And that was, you know, a safety measure they brought in by trying to change the culture. And I think it's a little bit similar within cybersecurity, is the fact that we need to be empowered to challenge. And so if you do receive a video call with a deep fake video at 2 a.m. from the CEO saying, please pay this $25 million invoice, that you're allowed to push back, that you're encouraged to say, hang on a second, sorry, boss, this is a bit weird. I need to go through the right process. So we all need to buy into that. And some of the good organizations I see are very clear about that sort of thing because of deepfake coming along. They're having statements from the CEOs saying, I will never ask you to do this. I will never ask you to break outside a process. I will always stick to the processes. And if you hear me asking you to break outside a process, then it's probably fake. Here's what you need to do instead. So there's lots of aspects like that. But the other piece of culture which really interests me in terms of behavioral culture is encouraging people to report. And again, an airline example fits in really well here. And that is talking to an organization about having an engineer who perhaps drops a bolt into a jet engine. And this bolt drops into a jet engine. At that point, the engineer has two choices. They can either go to their boss and say, I'm sorry, I've just potentially ruined $1 million engine. You're going to need to get all the people off that plane. We're going to need to take it out of service. We're going to need to take it apart. We need to rebuild it. It's going to be out for a month. It's going to have massive repercussions on our scheduling, and it's going to cost us a lot of money. That's option number one. That sounds like a pretty terrible message to have you tell your boss, frankly. Option number two is you don't say anything. You just keep quiet and pretend it never happened and let the plane take off and just hope it doesn't explode. So that's obviously what you do not want to happen. But from the cultural perspective, that's probably the easier thing for the engineer to do. So you have to have this concept of just culture. And that's very much about any mistakes anybody makes. It's not on you. It's not on you. You made, an error happened, but that's not your fault. Me as the manager did not create the right environment for you to succeed. You know, perhaps we can learn lessons from that. Perhaps we need magnetic bolts. Perhaps we need different ways of working. Perhaps we need two people doing that job instead of one. But you need to come to me and tell me that error happened, because that's the safe way forward. But I'm not going to shoot the messenger. I'm not going to blame you for the error. I'm going to take accountability for the error, because our processes weren't good enough to stop you making that error. And the same can be true of those the sort of deep fake things that we're seeing at the moment. There was one deep fake story just recently, wasn't there, where somebody paid $25 million to a fraudster. And fair play to that fraudster for getting away with that. But don't you think the problem there is the fact that one person could authorize a payment for $25 million? That's the problem here. You know, there's a process problem that should be fixed as well. So, you know, they can't blame the person for falling for the problem. They should look at the processes and go, we shouldn't allow this to happen again, because no one should have that amount of culpability to sort of sign a check on their own.
Yeah, which brings us back to this old framework of, you know, like insecurity, technology, organization, and people or humans are usually the three lenses you should look at the problem. And here, clearly, it was organization. So it was a process-related weakness, essentially, that made this possible. Maybe this aspect you mentioned, or like you highlighted, of error culture or adjust culture, this is something that has been with us since the beginning of our company. In the beginning, when we looked at security awareness and training, which was the name of the category. And let's jump over to the whole category evolution in a second. And just picking, for example, phishing simulations, we found the de facto standard in the industry being, we will test our employees and then, you know, maybe there will be consequences. So we said very, very early on, this is a very problematic cultural signal, because it actually prevents just culture, or it prevents error culture, because it makes people afraid. So we said, okay, let's turn this into a continuous educational measure, and also make it, if it's necessary, anonymous across the organization. And then it has a totally different framing and can actually act as a culture building tool, because people learn in a very protected environment. And this brings us to the final part where, you know, this is a development we have been hopefully also actively shaping a little bit, of taking the security awareness industry or software category that we have into the future, that is much more focused on, you know, positive reinforcement, with a focus on culture building and many other elements. And, you know, the industry of security awareness and training is in a very, very interesting evolutionary process. And very recently, your former colleagues at Forrester Research renamed the category from security awareness and training to human risk management. And apparently this is something we applaud very much, because we had been on this journey to change the mindsets of CISOs worldwide from this essentially focus on checkbox exercises, one-time measures, you know, negative reinforcement, to now a much more sustainable viewpoint on the human layer of security. So human risk management, a very, very interesting topic, and that's what we want to talk about now.
Oh, I think it's a broad topic. I think the category's only just come up, so I think there's going to be a level of immaturity about the definition for a little while. But it certainly is a sensible evolution of the space we're in, because, you know, awareness and training is fine, and that's a good start. That's where you need to start. You need to get that as a foundation. But I think we need to go deeper and start to actively monitor and manage the risks associated with human behavior and actions generally. So identifying what people actually do and whether that represents a risk. So do they regularly upload stuff from USB or download documents onto USB? Do they access risky websites? Do they choose poor passwords? Do they reuse passwords? Do they always use a VPN to come in from a coffee shop, or do they not? There's all these different things. Do they patch their machine straight away once the pop-up comes up, or do they just let it lie for a couple of weeks? All of these different behavioral choices represent a little bit of additional risk or a little less risk. And actually, we can start to bring all of these factors together to look at the individuals within our enterprises to understand who actually really does represent a risk to our organization. And you can overlay that with other information, such as, well, what information do they have access to? If that person does display quite risky behavior, but really all they've got access to is, you know, something that's inconsequential, then I'm not terribly worried. However, if they've got access to the merger and acquisition plans, the intellectual property that our organization is based on, to the, you know, next year's financial plans, then perhaps I'm more worried about that person, and so, because the risk they present is greater. So therefore, them showing risky behavior is much more of an issue for me as an organization. So I think it's about bringing all these different strands together to start to identify where the risks really are in terms of the people and the behaviors in your organization, and start to figure out what you can do to influence those, to reduce those risks. But I think it's still growing as a category. It still needs to evolve into its full definition.
And apparently, I mean, this, as you said, it's a process, it's an evolution. And I'm quite happy that we now really take this discussion on a more tangible level by also naming or like renaming the category. And I mean, you described certain elements. So it's more looking at an expanded behavioral universe that we look at, right? There is not only phishing clicks, or there's not only entering sensitive information into a login page, et cetera, et cetera. There's also many other behaviors that can pose a risk and that we also have to look at. There's also a discussion, obviously, over individual tracking, right? There we might have even look at a discussion of national cultures, right? There's internationally many different cultures. If you look at the US, apparently this is much easier accepted versus, for example, in the mainland of Europe. But I don't want to double click on the anonymity issue, but more on the mitigation strategy. So what will you do actually if you identified, okay, there are certain behaviors amongst individuals or groups of people, yeah, how to influence them? So we have training, we have communication, but what else could we have?
Well, we could start to put in additional controls in place. So you could start to say that somebody is demonstrating sort of riskier behavior. So actually what you could do is you could reduce the risk on that individual by saying, well, okay, I'm not going to allow you to have access to the merger and acquisition data. So while you're presenting a risk to me by either your behavior or your location, if you're working from China, something like that, then, you know, I'm going to reduce the personnel risk, the risk from you as a personal person, by reducing your permissions. Or I'm going to stop you receiving any incoming email for this period whilst you're working on this very, very sensitive data. So there's different levers you can pull, or you could automate. So you could sort of automate and say, what I'll do is whilst you're working on this data, whilst you're logging on in a strange way, then what I'm going to do is every hour I'm going to re-authenticate you via MFA, or I'm going to trigger a password every couple of days, password change. So there's lots of different levers you can pull to try and manage the risk around that individual. It just depends on you identifying those risky patterns and then addressing it. And some of those risky patterns may be that suddenly you're looking at data in a section of the network that you've never looked at before, or you're looking at data that none of your teammates look at. And that may look like an anomaly. And those can be indicators that has this account been compromised? Because it's not just all about the humans who you know. One of the big deals these days is credential compromise. So you can have Bob from accounts, and he's a stalwart employee, been there for years, loves the company, very loyal. But suddenly his account logs on at 3 a.m. from China, and that's a red flag. You need to know about that. It starts to look at data it's never looked at before. You know, we're not holding Bob accountable for this, but actually we need to know about that account. We need to know that account is acting suspiciously because that's a threat to our organization. So we need to be able to act on that. So doing that behavioral analysis is very important. And then you can start to, we talked about automation earlier, you can start to automate controls that either help validate that still is the right person, or, you know, or lock that account out rapidly if they can't go through those additional control stages. So it's an interesting position. It's going to be interesting to see how we develop all these tools and put these mitigation strategies in place, because it's wider than just policies and processes. You know, there's lots of intervention that needs to happen too.
For me, this is also the beginning of eventually the human layer security topic integrating further in the security stack, right?
Yeah.
In this case you described, it's about integrating into data loss prevention platforms, for example, or also finding your own position within the whole zero trust narrative, right? And that I find super fascinating, because it's about understanding people much better. And this is clearly also the mandate to our industry here, to really leverage our understanding of human behavior, of human motivation, of behavioral science, to integrate even further and show more value and impact amongst the entire security landscape.
Absolutely. It's going to be really interesting to see, because we've architected our business to put the human at the center of our enterprise. Now, the human is the most important aspect that we need to protect. And unfortunately, I think security departments are still not focused on that. Security departments still focus on the technology. They're still focused on the feeding and watering of that big tech stack. But actually, everything's moved on. Now the person is the key asset that we have. They are our primary attack surface. That's where we need to be focusing our attentions and our controls. And so this evolution of into human risk management is very much needed. And it'll be interesting to see how it develops to protect our organizations going forward.
Yeah. So we can summarize, there probably won't be a boring day for us in the upcoming years. So the human at the center of our thinking, but also of the key paradigms in security, will be a theme that will stay with us for the next decades, most likely. So absolutely. I'm super excited. And with that, we're coming to an end of our episode today. I'm super excited to further double click on various topics in the future with you, Andrew. And obviously here, thank you very much for being our guest the first time in our Human Firewall podcast. And thank you very much and wish you a great day.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure to be here, Niklas.
And of course, we hope you liked our episode today and you learned something. And if you enjoyed it, then please tune in next time and subscribe to our podcast.
The Human Firewall podcast by SoSafe is produced by Eerly Studios.